Welcome back. I'm Kristen Balls, and you're listening to Where I Left Off, a bookish podcast. And today, I'm joined by the author of Your Corner Dark, Desmond Hall, and we are talking about his upcoming YA release, Better Must Come. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Desmond.
Yes, man. Thank you. Appreciate it, Kristen. Thank you for being here. Looking forward.
Me too. And your book is incredible. But before we actually get to talking a little bit more about Better Must Come, one thing that I always ask all the authors is, what are you currently reading right now?
So I am a really practical reader. And what I mean by that is, whatever I'm working on, I'm doing simultaneous research.
Yes.
And life. And that sort of dictates what I'm reading. So right now I'm working on a World War II book. So I'm reading two nonfiction books, Bitter Years and Countrymen. You know, those are really great for that. And I'm also working on getting back to the Song of Solomon, which is, you know, the great Toni Morrison, who looks a lot like my beloved past mom, which is really wild. But I'm reading that one to get ready because my daughter is about to read it. And I want to be on my toes to be able to talk with her about that one. And I'm also reading Rachel Lynn Solomon's book, Past, Present, Future, because I'm about to meet up with her and I want to talk about it. And it's really cool and also timely because it's, you know, love story, which I love. And it's also about, you know, your first year of college, which I have a kid who's in that first year of college. So I'm reading all of these at once. And I have my books sort of opened up on the floor, you know, to the pages where I left off. So I'm sort of rotating through all the books.
That's what I do as well. Yeah, Past, Present, Future was really, really good. I just finished it pretty recently.
Don't tell me how it ends.
No, I won't spoil. But it's definitely worth the read. That's really cool that you actually get to read with your daughter and have discussions. When did you guys start that? Have you always kind of done that?
Always, always. I mean, from Miss Wishy-Washy to, you know, Are You My Mother? To Geronimo Stilton to, you know, up to, you know, Toni Morrison, Song of Solomon, The Odyssey, which, you know, Better Must Come is loosely based on. And so, yeah. There's some great Easter eggs in there because it's really a kind of a retelling of Homer's, you know, epic poem. Because, you know, you have the warrior Odysseus trying to find his way back home after the Trojan Wars. And Deja is trying to find her way back home after her, you know, encounter. And I love the idea of giving, you know, a young woman agency, you know, in this time. It's sort of a domain that's generally, this type of thriller, I mean, is usually reserved for young boys. But I love a young woman having the opportunity to go on this adventure and to, you know, live and, you know, exercise her agency.
Yeah, Deja is a kick butt character. You do not want to mess with her.
Yeah, Mom. No. I mean, Jamaica is such an island of strong women. You know, everybody, like, it's just, you have to pay kind of honor to that, you know? And she encapsulates that spirit. And it's also interesting, too, a lot of Jamaicans, even though the motto is out of many, one people, because, you know, it's about unity and about, you know, many different types of people coming together to make one Jamaican sort of family. But there's also a lot about the individual, you know, like people think I can do it. I can do it no matter what. Right. I can do. And, you know, there's a joke like you ask a Jamaican who knows nothing about carpentry, nothing about plumbing, you know, to build you a house. They'll just look at you and say, what color? You know, they just, you know, there's that I can get it done no matter what spirit. And Deja really, you know. Embodies.
I agree. So a little bit about your work in progress that you just said it was World War II based. How did you come up with that? And that sounds like a pivot from your first two novels.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing into this, you know, world of, you know, historical fiction. And it's really cool to research it. And the interest came from my wife's grandfather was in the resistance in World War II.
Oh.
Yeah. And he was a really tough dude. And I went on several walks with him when he was dying of cancer. And he told me so many of these stories, it just twisted my head, you know, to know what it was, or, you know, to feel what it was from somebody that was a teenager during this time when the Nazis invaded, you know, their country, and to rise up and fight against them because the adults weren't doing the job is, you know, this, I love this idea of valor, you know, this idea that you can, you know, stick up for a certain type of people that where you don't have skin in the game. It's like not, it's not your fight, but you're going to get in that fight because you think it's right. And that, I think, is amazing, you know. So that's really, you know, what brought me to that. And so I just finished that, and I just sent it off to my beloved agent, Faye Bender, earlier this week. So now I'm in that worry stage, you know. Oh, she hates it because it's been 10 days. No, she hates it because it's been 2 hours. You know, oh, she must love it because she's taking 2 weeks. You know, just going through all those different emotions.
I'm sure. Because I've heard that, I can't even remember where it was, but it was a quote that was saying basically whenever you're writing, you're kind of like turning your brain inside out for everyone to see. And they're looking at like your baby. And so I can't even imagine trying to wait on those kind of edits and kind of getting that back after a first draft like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's intense. You know, like writing is such a lonely business that you have to have like a great community. You know, so I have a community of other writers. I love, you know, love my family. You know, they're very, very, very supportive. You know, I used to be in advertising and I was Spike Lee's creative director, right? So, you know, I sort of left the business to go into the business of novel writing. And when I was, before I got, you know, Your Corner Dark published, you know, my first novel, I got an offer to move to Chicago for a lot of money to work as like one of the creative leads on McDonald's. And yeah, so that would help pay a lot for college. And, you know, my family was like, no, hang in there. You know, you put so many years into this, stick with it. And I'm like, oh, there's some things to be, you know, to be considered, like the bank account. But they said, hang in there. And like 2 weeks later, I got the offer for representation from not one, but two agents. And I got through, and it was like, you know, tough, but amazing at the same time.
That's incredible. How did you find your writer's group?
So Grub Street. I love Grub Street. A lot of people are really amped about either their high school, which I am, good old Holy Cross in Flushing, Queens, New York, but or their college. But, you know, for me, Grub Street is like, feels like the college I root for. You know, they are in the Final Four in my heart all the time. So there, I mean, I just think it's, you know, it's thought of as the best writing school in the country. And it also has the number one writers conference in the country, the Muse in the Marketplace. And I had heard about it, right? And as I mentioned earlier, you know, I have that Jamaican, I can do it myself kind of thing. And people kept saying, you know, check out Grub Street, Desmond, check out Grub Street. Yeah, I got it, I'm okay. But then I finally went down there and, you know, I met the also beloved Michelle Hoover in the Novel Incubator Program, which is an MFA level 1 year course, where I think it's better than an MFA because what it does is give you a book at while you're at the end of it. You know, a classical MFA rather gives you, you know, the ology. You know, it gives you the understanding of the books and, you know, the craft and such like that. But Grub, you know, with the Novel Incubator, you get not just the ology, but you also get the book. You know, you get the manuscript at the end of it. And then what they do is they walk you into the Muse in the Marketplace, where you get to meet all these top agents, editors, and such. And I think it's a great opportunity. And I'm, you know, I feel very lucky to have gotten in. I'm very thankful and I love them. Wish I had like a Grub Street pendant and sweatshirt to go, yay.
I mean, you could make one if you wanted to. Canva's always okay.
I'll work on it.
So what's the biggest difference between some of the writing that you're doing in advertising and writing novels? Because those are just two totally different like skill sets almost, I'm sure.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You know, I'm going to write an advertising book because it's crazy what I went through working with Spike Lee. You know, like I got to spend the night in the studio with Beyonce. I worked with Pharrell, worked with Kanye West before he blew up. And quite an interesting thing. And, you know, Spike himself is sort of legendary, you know, and he took me to some of the Knicks games and all of that stuff. So it's just amazing, right? But the thing about advertising is, in my time of advertising, before the advent of the internet, it was the sort of pinnacle was the high quality of the 30-second commercial. And to be great in 30 seconds is really, really tough, you know, and we had talked earlier about like print versus broadcast and, you know, broadcast is tough and so many hands are in the pot, you know, it's really, you really need like a great team to make the, you know, not just the commercial, but the campaign and the branding really great, you know, and fortunately we did some really great stuff back in the day. And I can't believe it's so long ago. But feels like yesterday. And then, you know, the print advertising also, to have a headline and a visual grab the reader and hook them and get the message across quickly is also like a crazy art form. And I also, I think, you know, I was sort of schooled in radio. You know, that was sort of my first thing for United States Post Office. I really learned a lot working for that when I was at Young and Rubicam to start out my ad career. And so it's really crazy, like to be punchy and deliver things in 30 seconds versus a novel, 70,000 words, you know, to get through for a classic YA novel, sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less, but, you know, a really, really different art form. And I really have to say, to be honest with you, I have studied the craft of novel writing a lot more than I did advertising, which I regret, you know, because there were some geniuses around. You know, there was Spike. There was also the legendary Bob Scarpelli that, you know, he was awesome for my career and taught me a lot. But I wish I'd learned more and focused in on that a little bit more. Because in the novel writing, I've taken so many novel writing classes that I really feel like I know the craft a lot better, in particular story structure. I think that's kind of like my specialty, you know, that's my sweet spot, you know, to be able to tell a compulsive story that like really moves and has, you know, it uses all of the different tools, whether it's dramatic irony, narrative drive, the characterization that becomes action, you know, all of those things I've really studied a lot. And I really love doing them.
Yeah, I can tell it really comes across in your book. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And I do tend to read a lot of thrillers. So it definitely set itself apart. And I liked the little bit of romance going on between two of the characters. Yes. I won't spoil it by saying their names, just, you know, just in case. So for readers that are looking to decide if they want to pick up Better Must Come, how would you kind of sum up the story in a couple sentences?
Better Must Come. In Jamaica, a Jamaican story. So if you've ever been to Jamaica, you see all the glossy TV commercials, right? Or you've seen the resort. But this is a story outside the resort. It's a tense story where Deja, she is a barrel girl. And a barrel child is someone that's left alone by their parents because the parents go to a foreign country. We call it foreign in Jamaica. And the kids are on their own because the parents can make more money in, you know, 2 years than they can 10 years back on the island. So one day, Deja is fishing. And she comes across a Go fast, boat. It's smeared with blood. There's a man. He's in trouble. She gets on board because she's a good daughter of a school teacher. And she tries to bind his wounds as he's bleeding out. She tries to start up the go fast to take him to safety. But he says, no. Take this case. This case? What case? She takes the case. It's filled with $500,000. Now, in Jamaica, you know, the conversion rate is more than 100 to 1. So that's a whole lot of money. And she, the dying man, who might or might not be a DEA agent, tells her to take the case across the island to this guy named Weber. And Deja is like, I can't do it, I can't do it. And in his seemingly dying words, he says, do it. He will reward you. Weber will reward you. And don't let them get it. And she's like, who's them? And the man then passes out. So Deja goes across the island, and there's a posse. And in Jamaica, a posse is a gang. And they're after that same bag of cash. And guess what? One of the love interests that Deja has had in her life is Gabriel, a kid in the posse who is an orphan, you know, similar feelings to abandonment that Deja has with her mom, not on the island. But it didn't work out. Could have worked out. We wanted to work out, but it didn't quite work out. It might still work out. And Gabriel is tasked with intercepting that same bag of cash. And their lives intersect as they scramble across the island in, you know, sort of life and death questions and decisions that have to be made. And it's not about just delivering the cash. It's not about just saving their own lives, but it's about saving other people's lives as well. And that, in a nutshell, is Better Must Come.
Yay, thank you. And it is really good. It's really, really good. I was very intrigued the whole time. I kept flipping pages on my Kindle like, okay, where are they going to get to next? And what's going to happen? And do I trust anyone? Yeah. I really couldn't figure out. I was constantly like, you know how whenever you're reading a thriller and you're just thinking of scenarios in your head and you're like, oh, I bet this is going to happen. Oh, are they even good? I don't even know. And so, yeah, that was constantly, constantly going through my head through this book. But on Deja and Gabriel, so it's a dual POV with chapters from both Deja and Gabriel. What made you decide to do it as a dual POV versus just focusing on Deja, the main protagonist?
So I love stories. And in particular, it seems that I really love budding love stories, you know, because I think when you meet somebody, that's sort of the most interesting time, whether it works out or not. You know, that first touch, you know, can I hold her hand? Can I touch her? You know, each word you say feels like, oh, I just messed up in what I said. I shouldn't have said that. You know, everything is just so important. And then, of course, that amazing first kiss, you know, that's like the things we remember, whether a relationship works out or not. But I also love when something crazy is between the two. They say every love story is a love triangle, and it's not necessarily another person. Sometimes it's, and many times it's a thing. And I read all these reports now about young people, you know, in our time, you know, worried about climate change, worried about things in the world. And these reports say it's a possible reason why the kids aren't like into romantic meetups. And I'm like, wow, that's crazy, you know? So in Gabriel and Deja's case in Better Must Come, the thing between them is this bag of money and this world of bad guys that want it and seeming good guys that also want it. And in order to have the love story really play out, I think two points of view is important because, like, you know, think about it, right? Like with your girlfriends or your boyfriends, they're telling you a story about their love interests and it's like, ah, oh, he said this, ah, oh, she said that. And, you know, it becomes this thing of like, he said, she said, and you don't really know the full story, right? But I think when you have two points of view, you get to see somebody say and do something on one side, but then you get to see the response on the other side. So you as the reader are sort of ahead of the characters, you know, when you have those two points of view. you can really do narrative, dramatic irony, you know, and put the reader way ahead of the characters. And I think that's really important, you know, and in Better Must Come, there's a lot of dramatic irony, you know, like the readers are constantly ahead of the characters, both in the plot, the A plot, and then the B plot as well with the love story. And I think having two points of view really allows you to see that. And I also get to, you know, tell more of Jamaica's story, you know, because Gabriel doesn't come from, he's a different class than Deja. You know, Deja's middle class. And then you have to say Gabriel's very lower class, you know, if you, you know, I put quotes around that because, you know, his world and his life has been really rough. And, you know, we get to understand that world, you know, not a world that you generally get to see. And, you know, I have had, you know, some family in Jamaica that have come from that world and so have an understanding of it. And I think it's important to show to young people that a lot of the bad choices that people make are the cause of economic conditions. Of course, as an old school teacher, I don't just say that on its face. I just put the landscape of it out there. And hopefully, you know, people will see that, like, this could have been a different person if they had some chances. Because a lot of times people say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Well, people can't. And, you know, they're forced into unenviable and bad choices and they pay for it. But it's, I think it's important to understand.
True. And like you're saying, you get a little bit more backstory from Gabriel of how he got into the posse and why he's in the posse and set up how he does want to get out. And if it were just from Deja's point of view, I don't think I would have liked Hammer as much either, because obviously she thought he was an idiot for a while. So, you know, versus seeing the kind of like banter between Gabriel and Hammer.
Yes, right. That I love these quote unquote secondary characters that I really love, and I love that you brought up Hammer, because I mean I grew up with a bunch of Hammers. You know, the guys that you only know them by their nickname. That's really popular in Jamaica, not just in the posse world, but like everywhere. You walk down the street and like, and you go, "Hey, do you know Courtney Fenton?" And people go, "Who?" And then you go, "Oh, Hammer. Oh, why didn't you say so in the first place?" You know, like, and, you know, he's one of those people that he's not anywhere near as educated as Gabriel is. And he comes from a different world and has particular understandings. Like, he doesn't feel the world is a circle. He feels the world is flat. And Gabriel, you know, and he argue about this all the time.
Yep.
And he has other, you know, particular beliefs that, you know, are really indicative of a lot of people. And I think it's important in the characterization to have those differences, in particular in Jamaica, where you get to see it. It was funny, I was watching a video the other day, like every day I watch the Jamaica Observer and the Jamaica Gleaner to see what's going on. And, you know, I keep in touch with family too. But it was funny. There was a huge ship that came into the port in Kingston that had all these heavy tankers and shipping containers stacked like a mile high. And the guys were like, "Oh, how it can float. You know, how is it floating? You know, it should sink." You know, and it's like, you know, it's just a funny thing to like just sort of capture that as well. And of course, the guys next to these people explained how, you know, the buoyancy works on the ship, you know. So I just made a really interesting dynamic because they're great friends. And, you know, to have a friend like Hammer that'll get you out of tough scrapes is as important, you know, to have someone that has your back all the time.
True. And then Hammer needs Gabriel's influence too, for sure, to keep him on the straight and narrow, or at least somewhat on the straight and narrow as much as he can.
Yes. Yes, we hope. We hope.
So where did some of the inspiration from Deja's character come from? You talked a little bit about Homer and the Odyssey for the overall story, but was there something that kind of inspired Deja specifically?
Yes, well, my sister was a barrel girl, and she passed away.
I'm sorry.
And you know, it left a life-sized hole that I'll never be able to fill, no matter how much therapy, you know, I go through. And so in a way, I wanted to give my little sister and young women all over some agency, a little bit of power, right, to live an adventure that they might not otherwise be able to live. And so that's where it came from. And telling this story of barrel children, you know, these children that are sort of left in all over the Caribbean, not just Jamaica, you know, where the parents leave to go make more money. And the kids are left to their own devices in to an extent, or they have, you know, a guardian or a family member looking out for them. But there's this interesting psychological phenomenon where the kids are sort of shamed if they ever complain about missing their parent, because they get these barrels, and these barrels are contained, filled with stuff, right? And they're sent back by the parents to the kids, you know, and it has everything from cooking oil to rice to jeans, cell phone covers, et cetera, et cetera. And I think people think then, oh, you have all this stuff, you know, so don't complain. But in reality, those kids would probably trade 10 barrels, 20 barrels to have their parents back. That's a sort of a hits my soul kind of thing. So I really wanted to make a story to, and since I do thrillers, oh, it's encapsulated within the thriller.
Yeah, and all the responsibility that Deja has as well. Yes. Trying to take care of her siblings and trying to make money for them and even just get the kids ready for school. And luckily she also has friends to help her, a really good group. But still that, yeah, I just can't imagine that much responsibility on a child, let alone them not being able to complain about missing their parent and all of that as well. And like she said at some point that, you know, the barrels are kind of a gift kind of a curse at the same time.
Yes, so true. So true. It's you have to grow up even quicker, right? And even more. And in a way, you know, how can she be a substitute mother? She never can be, right? And because she's a daughter. And that sort of conflict is really interesting. And throughout the story, you know, hopefully this isn't a spoiler, she gets to understand, you know, why her mother, she knew why her mother left. But, you know, there's a hurt, you know, because it's a sort of abandonment. And to be able to understand that abandonment on a deeper level is something that I think is a bit of a gift for her. It's a pretty big accomplishment to be able to really get why you're feeling the way you're feeling on that deeper subconscious level.
I agree. Yeah, she definitely goes through a journey from the beginning to the end, not just deciding what to do with the cash, but emotionally, for sure.
Yes. Yes.
I was going to ask, so you really excelled not only at the dialogue, but at the imagery, just with really any of the scenes from the novel. What did you kind of use to research to be able to use these technically real places that were in a fiction novel so you could kind of make them however you wanted?
Oh, man, you're getting into all the secrets. So in the film world, directors and cinematographers get together and they work on image systems, right? And, you know, like, for example, you take a movie Casablanca. It's an example used often. It's World War II, and people are stuck in Casablanca trying to, you know, escape the Nazi danger. And a lot of the imagery done in that great film is about, you know, imprisonment. So there's like a searchlight that, like, very subtly, right? Because it always has to be done subtly to work on the subconscious, but hopefully the subconscious and the conscience merge as well. But there's a searchlight. There's use of shadows in the background that portrays a sort of imprisonment. Bars sometimes. Sometimes there's a web, you know, and the love interests, Bergman and Bogart, there's a separation between them. And many times when the relationship isn't working out, there's something, obstruction that, you know, the cinematographer and director have created to sort of show that they're apart. You know, they're sort of imprisoned by their own feelings for each other. So in creating those image systems, it really helps novelists as well. Because many times, you know, like we talked about before in broadcast, there are a lot of hands in the, you know, a lot of cooks in the kitchen. But in novel world, the writer gets a lot of leeway in creating that image system. And I think creating it and seeding it subtly throughout the story is really helpful in creating the imagery, not just putting it in there for the symbolism, but it also tells you what to do. You know, it really gives you sort of a guidance on how to set up the scene, how to seed that the word picture right away, and how to use that in places to help turn the scene. I find that really, you know, helpful. So I use that a lot in order to create the imagery for Better Must Come. And as I said, it's sort of based on the Odyssey. You know, it's a loose retelling of it. So in the book, in Better Must Come, you're going to find, you know, a cyclops. You're going to find the sirens, the three sirens. You're going to find the cow prophecy. You're going to find, you know, a whole lot of things, the return home. You know, those things are all seated in there. And that really helped in the imagery for Better Must Come.
That makes sense. Yeah, because it really was like a movie in your head, yeah. For sure. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So what is the most challenging thing about just writing a thriller in general? I guess the main question is, like, do you start out, you know where it's going to end, but, you know, all those little subtleties, do you plan out beforehand or do you kind of like go back after you've written the first draft and add them in?
Oh, I am a compulsive plotter. I do not write word one. It's great. I feel like I'm talking to a plotter because I think it's impossible to write, to be a pantser, person that writes by the seat of their pants, to create a thriller. You know, you have different storylines, you have different arcs. And to create that and help it make sense throughout is just, I think, impossible. So I sit down and I outline like crazy. I took, you know, the beloved Robert McKee's story class 3 times, you know, in order to like really understand and feel what's going on. I also worked with, of course, Spike Lee, worked with Lodge Kerrigan, an independent film director, and really worked on a lot of story structure when I was in, you know, the film world. And it's really helpful to be able to understand where the story needs to go. And I think there's like a great merging that happens after you do that. Because after you've done all that plotting, you can become a pantser if you dig into the perspective of each character. And you sort of, it's sort of like a bank that you create. Is the character tall? How are they college educated? Are they religious? And then you can go back. The more you fill that bank up, unlike my bank account, you can like, you know, withdraw on an unlimited basis. And you then are able to pull out, make all those withdrawals from the bank of perspective to really be a pantser and really fill in, you know, not just the world of that character, but their characterization. It also helps in like further creating the plot. So I think, you know, outlining is key. It's essential. In fact, I can't see it done without it. You know, it has to be done for Better Must Come.
I agree. Yeah, especially for thrillers in general. That seems like a really hard genre to try to pants that one.
Right. And on top of that, each chapter in Better Must Come has a date and a timestamp.
True.
Right? And, you know, kind of, you know, that's like, oh, really keeping all that in mind while juggling 3 plot lines and 2 POVs. And, you know, I have to give a shout out to my beloved editor, Caitlin DeLuy. She was really helpful. My dyslexic brain doesn't fully the whole timing of things as I'm juggling all of these things. And she really helped in, you know, keeping me right on track with that.
Nice. If you are looking for a fantastic YA thriller with some romance mixed in, make sure that you pick up Better Must Come. It's coming out soon. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Where I Left Off, a bookish podcast, and sign up for Desmond's newsletter. You can visit his website and purchase his novels all through the links in the show notes. Tune in next time.